From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday took up the baton of the impeachment process from the House Intelligence Committee, holding its first public hearing. Four constitutional scholars and professors were called in to be witnesses, three of them by Democrats and one by Republicans. Professor Noah Feldman of Harvard University laid out the logic of the Constitution's framers in designing an impeachment process. Professor Pamela Carlin of Stanford University sharply rebutted Republicans for avoiding the facts of the Ukraine scandal at the heart of the process. And Michael Gerhardt, who is at the University of North Carolina, stated succinctly, "If what we're talking about isn't impeachable, then nothing is impeachable." On the Republican side, Jonathan Turley, a professor at George Washington University, claimed to be nonpartisan but denounced the impeachment process and said it was moving too fast and would set a dangerous precedent. Well, the public has been hearing from a number of constitutional scholars today, and we will turn to yet another constitutional scholar on our show. Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality. He's also the author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. He's been one of our go-to guests on this issue. Welcome back, Corey.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and a big day today.
It is. Wednesday's day, which was Wednesday, had the first day of hearings for the Judiciary Committee, by the Judiciary Committee. That all of that is based on the report that the House Intelligence Committee put together from hours and hours, and in fact, really months, weeks and months of testimony that was culminated in this package of evidence that then the Judiciary Committee has been debating this week. First of all, can you give me your impression of these hearings? It seems as though, at least on this first day of hearings, they're much more exciting than the very careful answers of the witnesses who were, you know, who were basically there to provide evidence.
Yes, I mean, we're getting to the closing arguments now, and that's always the most exciting part of any trial. It's when all of the sort of hard work that we've done, those of us who've been following along, of seeing how the dots connect, now people are bringing them together for us. And to me, you know, there was a worry, is bringing professors in going to be boring? Is it going to be abstract? And I didn't think that was true at all, especially when you listen to Pam Carlin. She really presented a closing argument, pulling together all of the different strands and showing why, given the understanding of the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors, its function in the Constitution, why there really is an obligation to move forward. The other witnesses were great too, but I thought she stood out. And she also wasn't afraid to mix it up when the ranking member sort of made a crack in the beginning, a very sort of thoughtless crack of, oh, these people probably haven't had time to, you know, listen to the details of every minute of the hearings. She shot right back and she said, you know, this is what I do. I'm a scholar. I'm a professional.
She said it was insulting.
Yeah, every single line. And I'm insulted by that. And I just thought it was a really terrific instance of a person who has respect for facts, speaking truth to power. And that was a dramatic moment, and it was followed by some very hard-hitting conclusions and summary argument. Also, you know, these are advocates in addition to scholars. Pam Carlin is a great litigator, and you saw her using those tools. I think, though, her client was the American people. She was speaking on behalf of all of us.
Yeah, I would agree with you that Professor Carlin was seemed to be the star witness on Wednesday. What do you make of Chairman Nadler, who is, you know, a little bit different from Adam Schiff, who heads the House Intelligence Committee, and who is a lawyer, and who, you know, was quite sharp in the way in which he pulled the threads together around the evidence that was collected. Nadler, you know, has his own different style, but he seems to also be pretty focused on what's at stake.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the whole idea of these hearings, which we now understand, was to collectively bring people in to help the American people understand how the evidence connects to this very fundamental process of impeachment and the power to remove an abusive president. And what I liked about Nadler in particular was his focused explanation using the witnesses that this is really about abuse of power. That's what we're talking about. And yes, there are crimes here, but it's more than that. It's a president who's threatening our elections going forward.
Corey, one of the things that came up in the report from the House Intelligence Committee and also came up on Wednesday during the hearings was the obstruction of justice charges from the special counsel's report from the Mueller probe, which I thought was interesting and a little bit unexpected. Were you also surprised?
I've been saying, I think going back to our original conversations, that it's very important to have a broad inquiry here. I think there's been a debate, an internal debate within Congress. Should we really focus on the crimes of the phone call specifically, or more generally on the abuses of power, in other words, the high crimes and misdemeanors of the president more generally that we know about? And that certainly would include the Ukraine phone call first and the abuse of power involved there, the trade for military aid and general assistance to the Ukrainian economy in exchange for a personal favor to the president to provide dirt on his political opponent. That's a no-brainer. That's, you know, clearly the first article of impeachment. But should we have more? And I think some were arguing we want to focus on the clear thing that the American people know is wrong and not risk expanding it. And my view is we really don't want to do that. We want to talk more generally about the abuses of power here, and that has to include the obstruction of justice, both the obstruction of justice outlined in the second part of Mueller's report, the obstruction of justice in the Mueller investigation, but also the obstruction of Congress that you heard about and the refusal, blanket refusal, to comply with legally required subpoenas. And I support the broad approach, which looks like they're following now. The thing I've heard less of, but that I'd like to see eventually take center stage here, is the emoluments violations of the president, the use of the office for personal profit when it comes to the hotel or negotiating with China for intellectual property on behalf of his family, the accusations in these emolument suits. I think that would be a great fourth article, but certainly three, I hope, and now I expect, will be part of this these articles of impeachment in this first round.
What do you make of the Republicans' witness, Jonathan Turley, who I mentioned, you know, in his opening statement, he said, I didn't vote for Trump, I'm not a Trump supporter, but who seems to have been basically towing the Republican line in the questioning on Wednesday?
He got better as time went on. I mean, I strongly disagreed with several of the things. As a scholar, I was really in sharp disagreement with his characterization of the Johnson impeachment. Now, this might seem abstract, but I do think it's important to talk about, and I'll explain why. But to him, he follows what John F. Kennedy says in Profiles in Courage, which is that this was a partisan impeachment. It didn't focus on real crimes, and it was a mistake. And that is a line that historians used to take. But as we really think more about Andrew Johnson's administration, this was the most racist president in history who actively campaigned to undermine the rights of African Americans and to disregard the 13th Amendment, the entire reason that the war had been fought ending slavery. That was the real motivation of that impeachment. Now, it's true that there was a controversial question about whether or not a cabinet member, the Secretary of War, could be fired. And that's what Turley focused on. But he really ignored the larger abuse of power. Now, why is that not just an abstract, wonky academic point? Because that's what's really going on here. What they were debating is, should we be narrowing the question of the president's offenses to specific criminal statutes? Or should we be having a broader conversation about abuse of power? And I strongly advocate the idea that it should be broader understandings of abuse of power that are relevant here. And Professor Turley was wrong both in the 19th century case and when it comes to this present case as well.
He seemed to continually suggest that the Democrats were rushing through a process But it didn't see it hasn't seemed like they've really been rushing. At least the groundwork laid by the Intelligence Committee seems pretty methodical. One would argue that the Mueller probe was far too prolonged, and you know, some people characterize the results of that as a nothing burger. but then I mentioned that Michael Gerhardt, the Democrats' witness, made it very clear: if this isn't impeachable, then literally nothing is impeachable. So is Turley just, you know, shilling for Trump and the Republicans and saying that's just moving too fast, that's a dangerous precedent?
I mean, he had arguments. So I don't know that I'd go as far as to say that he's shilling. And, you know, he was trying to narrow what counts as an impeachable offense. And he pointed out that the word maladministration, for instance, was rejected during the founding debates because it was too broad. So, but I think the fact that one word is too broad doesn't mean that there isn't a broad concern in the Constitution about exactly this kind of abuse of power. And where I really thought he fell short is that he claimed that there wasn't evidence of a quid pro quo or an illegal act when it comes to the phone call. But if you listen to Sondland testify before Schiff's committee, if you just read the transcript, the readout of the phone call between the president and the Ukrainian, the president of the United States and the president of Ukraine, it's very clear to me that there was a straightforward illegal trade, a solicitation, first of all, of information, the basically campaign aid in violation of our campaign finance laws, likely a bribe. A demand for a public official for a thing of value in exchange for an official act. Those are illegal and also abuses of power. And he never said why he thought the evidence wasn't there. And if I sort of was perplexed because although Pam Carlin, you know, claimed, and I certainly believe, that she looked at every single line that was said, I don't see how you would have sat through Sondland's testimony or David Holmes' testimony and said that. I mean, they corroborated what we all knew to be true from day one, which was that there was a vast abuse of power, the trade of massive amounts of money on behalf of the American people in exchange for personal dirt on a political rival. I mean, that is a violation both, I think you could argue, bribery, campaign finance, certainly the general high crime and misdemeanor point about abuse of power. But it's also harkens back to when John Adams sought to prosecute his political opponents and shut down an opposition party. I find that, you know, up there with why that is so offensive to the basics of the rule of law, and why, as you heard, we don't impeach on this. It's not clear what we would impeach on. Now, what was the rebuttal from this witness, from Mr. Turley? I just don't know. I didn't hear any argument on that crucial point, if he's going to make that claim.
And in fact, I want to just remind our audience that Jonathan Turley is an expert on impeachment. He was a witness in 1998 in the Clinton impeachment proceedings. And I want to quote from one of the things that he said back in 1998. He said, "If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy." In that case, we were talking about a president who lied about having an affair. You know, in, relatively speaking, given what we're dealing with today, that just seems so trivial, right? But Turley seems to not be as concerned about law breaking in the government today in 2019.
I do find it bizarre. I mean, I think like many people, I'm revisiting the Clinton impeachment, and I do think that there were things that were done there that you know, even if Starr wasn't a perfect independent prosecutor, I think there are reasons to think that impeachment might have been justifiable in retrospect. But it's because of this instance that we see that most clearly. And the idea that you would defend Clinton's impeachment and be against this one struck me as beyond bizarre. I mean, the real abuse of power wasn't during the Clinton impeachment, even if it was impeachable. The extreme instance is using a foreign government to dig up dirt on a political opponent. And the idea that we don't have evidence to that is absurd. And so, yes, I was very disappointed with that testimony and certainly did not agree with that.
The Republicans seem to be on the Judiciary Committee, seem to be continuing the tactic of focusing on motivations behind the impeachment process rather than the actual facts of the impeachment inquiry and the evidence around it. Do you feel that essentially the Judiciary Committee Republicans are similar, have taken that similar approach as the Intelligence Committee Republicans?
They weren't as aggressive, I thought. I mean, the Intelligence Committee Republicans, Jordan, for instance, was outrageous. I mean, it was just a lot of yelling and sort of disregard of facts. And, you know, he had witnesses telling him point blank what was happening, and he just was sort of acting in a rage. It was the most anti-intellectual display that I've ever seen. Now, I thought that these witnesses were going to be treated in a similar way, and I didn't see that because I think the facts are out. And in fact, I think that the ranking member said at one point, you know, I can't remember his exact words, but something to the effect that they were very impressive, like, no kidding. He said the obvious truth. He should have stopped at that. So they're not able to dig in the same way that now that we have the facts. I think that's what was so great about David Holmes' testimony and Sondland's testimony. Sondland doing it for self-serving reasons, Fiona Hill and David Holmes, heroes for just telling the truth for the common good. But once now that we have that, it's just hard, I think, to dig in the same way. So now they're forced to try to make legal arguments, and they just didn't know what they were doing. I mean, at one point, the ranking member said, well, we can't even know what things meant during the founders' time period. That's the whole theory of the Republican conservative approach to constitutional interpretation, is the idea of original meaning. So they were just all over the place. And you know, I think the closing argument of Pam Carlin just said it best. It brought together all of the ideas about what impeachment is and abuse of power and the brute facts that this president used a foreign government, the thing the framers really did fear the most, to try to influence our elections. I also thought that there was a clear rebuttal of the point that you were making, Sonali, which is that the Republicans keep saying, well, this is a coup, it's going to overturn the election, the motivation here is partisan. And the response to that also that Pam Carlin made so clear is, well, the whole issue here is that the president is trying to influence and hack the election, to try to cheat in the election, violating the laws. So that's the purpose of impeachment, is to preserve democracy, to preserve the system. And if a president is undermining it, we can't just allow the election to happen with that unchecked.
Now, the process as it's going to be playing out, I'm wondering if you can take us through that, Corey. The Judiciary Committee's responsibility is to determine whether or not to draw up articles of impeachment, right? And if so, what those articles of impeachment are. So I understand that the report that will emerge after this committee conducts its hearings will include some articles of impeachment, likely?
Correct. And, you know, it's a similar process that we saw during the Nixon impeachment, where I think the chairman and the committee will have a report, and then there'll be proposals of various specific articles of impeachment, and they'll be, I think, divided up. Certainly there'll be one about the high crimes and misdemeanors involved in the Ukrainian phone call and possibly the bribery charge as well. I think that will be packed into the first article of impeachment. And my prediction is that there'll be a second about Donald Trump's refusal to comply in any way with the congressional investigation, the refusal of subpoenas for all members of the executive branch, the obstruction of Congress, and that was also an article of impeachment during the Nixon era that was voted up. And then a third thing is the obstruction of justice in the Mueller investigation, the 10 instances that Mueller outlines of obstruction of justice, including the attempt to fire Mueller himself. We could go through the various others. I think that'll be a third article of impeachment. Certainly, I would recommend, even if they don't do it, that would be my approach.
Do you think there's any value to House Democrats waiting for court cases around the subpoenas of witnesses to play out? We have not heard from former White House counsel Don McGahn. We have not heard from former National Security Advisor John Bolton and his aide, Charles Kupperman. Kupperman and McGahn are involved in separate but parallel court cases around who they should comply with the White House directive or House subpoenas. Haven't we heard enough evidence?
That was Jonathan Turley's argument. Mm-hmm. He was saying that they certainly shouldn't include, and that it was wrong during the Nixon impeachment to include an obstruction of Congress article, because it's really up to the courts to decide where that balances. Now, the problem is the courts are not moving and have been extremely slow in addressing these subpoenas. The Supreme Court could have taken that case and answered the question of whether or not the subpoenas are valid and these people have to appear. Now, in the absence of court action, to me, the Congress has to take matters into their own hands. And the Constitution says clearly, in a case called Nixon versus the United States, not about Richard Nixon, but about a judge, makes it clear that the sole power to make determinations is that of the House. And the House has to be able to defend its own procedures, its own power. And the power of subpoena is what gives it the power to investigate impeachment. Without it, it starts to cut down on what it might mean. So it's a defensive mechanism of the institution to include an article of impeachment about obstruction of Congress. And the fact that the court hasn't acted is all the more reason to do it and not to wait.
Now, let's talk about Rudy Giuliani, whose name figures prominently in the House Intelligence Committee's report and whose name came up so many times during the witness testimonies. He is Trump's personal lawyer, not a government official, and evidence suggests that he was directing U.S. foreign policy to benefit Trump personally. And as the Judiciary Committee was holding its first hearing, where was Giuliani? But in Europe, speaking with former Ukrainian prosecutors to apparently launch some documentary to undermine the impeachment process. He has some impunity, it seems.
His behavior as mayor, I thought, was outrageous, and it's only increased. He's really become a caricature of somebody who's disregarding the law, who seems to think that he is above the law.
And by the way, ominously, Corey, you might have heard about the fact that he has suggested that if Trump throws him under the bus, that he has something on Trump. He's sort of suggested that twice. I mean, this is like some mafia movie playing out.
Right. I'm one of the news shows, and he's fond of saying just because the mafia didn't kill him, nobody will be able to stop him. So he essentially threatened the president of the United States. He's just a sort of silly character, and he's at the center of this. And Trump, what a mistake, was turning foreign policy over to this really wacky individual who's creating a back channel going against.
But their wackiness sort of is in line with one another's, right? I mean, it seems as though only a president like Trump would deserve a lawyer like Giuliani and vice versa.
Kind of divine justice. Yeah, there is a recklessness to both of them and a failure to respect the law. I think they both use the law as a sort of weapon, or think that they are, rather than to revere the idea of the checks and balances or the Constitution or respect for Congress. To them, it's all power, all political, and really all about personal gain. This instance of the back channel and the disregard of the rule of law, the recklessness of it, I suspect that there's a criminal investigation of Giuliani. And unlike the president of the United States, he definitely doesn't have immunity. Many of the cronies, of course, have already been prosecuted. Roger Stone is another instance of somebody who displays that kind of character. So this is in many ways a executive branch that has criminally minded individuals associated with it. Roger Stone is one example. And my guess is that Rudy Giuliani might be next.
Finally, Corey, what do you make of the repeated obsession in the corporate media of poll numbers and the public's position on impeachment? It feels like literally every other day or every few days there's a new poll, and the headline is that the poll numbers haven't budged, that the, you know, there's people have dug their heels in and they are either for the impeachment or against it, and roughly 50-50. It doesn't matter.
Look, thank you for paying attention to that issue and calling it out. I mean, to my mind, the more we get in this horse race and we don't focus on the obligations of the Constitution, we disregard our fundamental duty. After the Mueller report came out, that's when I favored impeachment, and I was getting a lot of response, but the polls, but the polls. The polls are not fixed. If you do the right thing, good constitutional obligation, I believe, is also good politics. And what we've seen actually in the polls, to the extent that that matters because it does put pressure on representatives to do the right thing, is we're seeing an increase as Congress does the right thing, as the public is informed. Support for impeachment grows, and certainly support for the inquiries are in the high 50s, where it was much lower before, and support for impeachment and removal is now a little over 50%. But you're absolutely right. Obsession with that gets in the way of doing the right thing. And finally, Congress is doing the right thing. And because of this show and others like it, I think the American people are learning what happened.
Corey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure we'll have you back on again in the future as this process continues.
My pleasure, always.
My guest
Thank
has been
you.
Corey Brettschneider. He's a professor of political science at Brown University. He's written several books, including The Oath and The Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. We've been discussing the Judiciary Committee's hearings on impeachment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.